permanently, abandoning both him and his 10-year-old brother, Robert. My father's mother, Helen Malkin, née Kirschenbaum, thus became one of those rare and shameful things in respectable if poor Brooklyn Jewish circles. A single mother. A Shanda, they would have whispered. What's wrong with her? When Maddie was 12 or so, my grandmother came home and announced that he should dress nicely because he was to meet someone, a special someone, and that he was to address this new gentleman, upon meeting him, as Dad. The marriage to Mark Sagal, a 40-ish bachelor who did not have and perhaps did not want any children, soon followed, as did formal adoption of Helen's son. Maddie, now Sagal, duly followed his new dad and his old mom out to Mark Sagal's new job in Highland Park, Texas, a suburb of Dallas filled with prosperous oilmen, their pleasantly dutiful wives, and their colored help. For a Jewish kid from Brooklyn, it must have been as alien as Ouagadougou. Decades later, after my grandpa's death, I learned that this and other moves in his life might have had something to do with his unreliability as an engineer, which might have had something to do with his reliability as a drinker of the scotch and waters that, later on in the 1970s, I would watch him and my father stir and sip in Grandpa and Grandma's apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. I've looked through my father's yearbook from Highland Park High. There are the tall, handsome, pretty, blonde Texans on the football and baseball and cheerleading squads, and there is Maddie Sagal with his shiny black hair and horn-rimmed glasses in the school play on the masthead of the school paper. If during that time in his life my father ever moved for pleasure, for exercise, or for competition, there is no photographic record of it. Off he went to college to study engineering, as his stepfather demanded, and then to graduate school, and then to marriage, and then, as one did then, to choose between two or three competing offers from large corporations, each promising full employment until a pensioned retirement and a comfortable death. The choice made, Bell Laboratories, he and his wife, my mother, Reva Sagal, née Skolnick, duly moved to New Jersey, and duly reproduced, first Doug, born in 1962, then myself in 1965, and then our brother Roger in 1970. By the time the day of that basement memory came around, Mattie, now Matthew W. Sagal on his business cards, Matt to his friends, and Matt the Rat to his enemies in office politics, was a suburban dad, such as I was to become, working for a single employer that provided him security and income stability such that his children wouldn't be suddenly jerked across the country due to the whims of their parents' failures in marriage or employment or sobriety. He must have felt, as I did when I arrived at that age and station some decades later, that he was getting older before his time, that, like the astronaut in the final sequence of 2001 A Space Odyssey, he could look across the room and see the old man he was going to become, huddled over a soup dish or tucked into a bed with the covers up to his chin, laboring to breathe. He decided to get some exercise. Thus, there he was in the basement, jogging in place, trying to get his knees as high as he could, occasionally waving his arms up above his head in the manner of a jumping jack. I remember him puffing his breath out and in through pursed lips like a fish, his bald head beaded with sweat. What an idiot, I thought to myself. From that day onward, riding the pressure wave of the 1970s running boom, he continued to run like an idiot all over suburban New Jersey, sometimes with me watching, on one disastrous occasion, with me following along in a community 10K on my banana seat bike, but eventually with me openly mocking. I protected my pudgy, uneasy, unattractive self with a layer of sarcasm that thickened as I approached adolescence, and I gave my father more than his fair share of it. Funny, Dad, you ran 6 miles. I stayed here eating frozen waffles, and looky here, we both ended up in the same place. He didn't react to these provocations. He just snorted a bit and shook his head and went to shower. But secretly, I envied him. Just like about everyone in that time and place and demographic, my father had purchased a copy of Jim Fix's The Complete Book of Running, the Quran of the 1970s running boom. I would leaf through it sometimes when nobody was around, and for a slow, unathletic kid like me, it was a kind of porn. I admired the photograph of the author's lower half on the cover, the right leg in the background tucked up toward the shorts the foot blurred in motion as it finished its upward arc, and then the left leg in mid-stride, pushing off the ball of an Onitsuka Tiger racing flat, the whole photo, a Michelangelo masterpiece of delineated muscle. I would look at my doughy thighs, stretch them out, and search for any hint of muscle within. It was like looking for a needle in a stack of jello. The legs remain, I am happy to report, on the cover of the copy Jim Fix's son sent me after I wrote about the book for Runner's World. On the back flap, the author comes running straight at you, as if he can't wait to give you the good news. Like all of history's greatest evangelists, e.g. Saul of Tarsus, Fix was a convert. When he started running several years ago, the flap copy reads, Jim Fix weighed nearly 220 pounds and breathed hard just thinking about exercise. Today, at 159 pounds, he has been declared medically fitter than most college athletes and has run the equivalent of once around the equator. The book is just as I remember it. There are those particularly mid-70s-ish black ink drawings, strangely and uncomfortably, like the ones in The Joy of Sex, which my father didn't have on his shelf, at least not that shelf. All the runners pictured are skinny guys with sideburns and girls with ponytails in cotton t-shirts and blissed-out faces. And then there is the heart of the book, the promises. Fix didn't call them that, of course, but to me that's what they were, promises of what would happen if you, if I, could only run. Running will make you healthy and slender, a cure for almost any modern illness, Chapter 1, happier and more peaceful, Chapter 2, and you'll be able to enjoy this peaceful, happy life long into old age, Chapter 4. To do it, all you need is a pair of good running shoes for which you should be willing to spend as much as $20 to $40 and shorts. Period. Fix reserved his only doubt about running for shirts and socks. He wasn't sure you needed either. Pro tip, socks are good. I turn to my favorite chapter, Chapter 14, Eat to Run, Good News If You Really Love Food. I did, and do, love food. And back then, food was the only one of my many growing appetites I could practically indulge. So I was in dire need of some good news. I used to read that chapter over and over, gazing at the ink drawing of the huge plate of spaghetti and meatballs. Fix praises the then-new idea of carbo-loading. And even though I had yet to run a step, or ever imagined that I could, I had a head start on that art. To be able to eat what I wanted and not feel sick or guilty, or as if I were swelling like a balloon, the impact of this pretty simple book, so low-key by the standards of today's glossy fitness Bibles with their lurid cover photos of the fantastically fit celebrity trainer in the cover, is hard to overstate. The book had 30 printings in its first 2 years and sold more than 1 million copies internationally, those figures coming from the foreword to Jim Fix's second book of running, which Fix published, somewhat sheepishly, as a sequel to The Complete Book of Running 3 years later in 1980. But the more impressive figures are those describing the running boom itself. He estimates the number of runners in the United States as growing from 6 million when he sat down to write the first book to 25 million as he published the second, a fourfold increase in just a few years. This was the era of jogging suits and headbands, with the rise of Nike and the making of Michael Douglas's most obscure movie, Running, in which the addicted hero starts the film putting on suit and tie and sneakers, then begins to run and is soon sprinting across the Queensboro Bridge to pick up his daughter from his estranged ex-wife with his tie wrapped around his forehead in lieu of a sweatband, as one does. When I saw that movie on TV one night in 1980, I couldn't imagine doing any of those things. As for Fix, he went from being an obscure author of intellectual puzzle books to a wealthy, best-selling one, and a national and international celebrity doing the talk show circuit, appearing in ads for American Express, Do You Know Me?, and Quaker Oats, but not, despite a lucrative offer, Budweiser. He loved beer, his friend Buzz McCoy told me, but he just didn't think it was appropriate for a fitness advocate to advertise it. McCoy met Fix on the streets and trails of suburban Connecticut, where they both lived and ran in the 70s. He says Fix was a social runner, talented but never intensely competitive, the kind of man who would jog in the last few miles of a race with a friend rather than blazing ahead to get a better time. It was his lack of ego, McCoy believes, that made his book so successful. He says his personality, his unassuming nature, and his modesty, it made running not a he-man thing, but something for 40-year-old divorced women and young women and people who had beer bellies, people who couldn't walk in a straight line. It opened it up to them. And, I could have added, it opened it up to husky teenagers in suburban New Jersey. In 1984, Jim Fix died at the age of 52, satisfactorily and distantly old to me when it happened, now about my age as I speak, of a massive heart attack suffered while on his daily 10-mile run. He was found, true to his creed, by the side of a country road, shirtless in just shoes and shorts. There were those who cried, "Ha! Running will kill you!" Others pointed out that Fix had inherited the same congenital heart defect that killed his father at an even younger age. Some pointed their fingers at Fix's dismissal of good nutrition. Maybe runners can't, or at least shouldn't, eat anything they liked. But it was probably mostly this. Buzz McCoy remembers that for all of his friends' obsession with running as a pathway to health, Fix himself never saw, or even knew, a doctor. Back in 1980, all that was yet to come. But on a certain evening in the spring of that year, when I was 15, I shuffled over to my father, my eyes fixed on the shag carpet, and asked him if I could get up with him the next morning to go running. He didn't say any of the things that I expected to hear, like, "What? All this time you've been making fun of me and now you want to come along? Guess you feel like looking like an idiot too, huh?" He just said, "Sure, I'll wake you up at 6. And he did too, damn him. What had changed my mind about running? Well, at some point around that time, I had become painfully aware that I put most of my physical self, the 5 feet or so of it below the neck, to very limited use. Mostly, it transported my head from dining tables to classes to bed, stopping to occasionally point it at the TV. It was a waste of a body, and my appearance, pudgy, pale, bepimpled, wouldn't have inspired anyone to disagree. My father was no Adonis. Nobody in my lineage of stocky Jews has been, or ever will be, employed as an Abercrombie and Fitch model, but I could see the muscles in his legs, and he could walk upstairs without gasping, which seemed impressive enough. If he had looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger or Bruce Jenner, if he had those long, striated legs as on the cover of The Complete Book of Running, I never would have attempted to emulate him. Instead, I would have just left to find my real parents. This is what I remember about that first run. My orange Keds slapping against the suburban asphalt for all of a half mile, and then my lungs exploding. I remember the gentle upward slope of a neighborhood street feeling like K2. I remember my father at my side, glancing at me occasionally, still not mocking, taking no vengeance, not then, not ever. I remember gasping that I was done, and then shuffling back home, wheezing and coughing while he continued on methodically up the hill. Many, many years later, I asked my father what he remembers about that day, and he said, "You came along in a pair of sneakers and puffed as you ran, but you came the next morning and then again. After a while, you asked for and got a pair of real running shoes. In a few months, you amused your adolescent self by running around me in circles." He is correct. My improvement was so rapid, I was 15, for God's sake, which is a gift even to those otherwise ungifted, that one day, soon after I started to run, on a beach in Florida, I literally ran in circles around my father while he ran straight up the beach, creating a pleasing helical pattern of footprints in the sand. I was laughing like a schoolboy, which I was, and running like an athlete, which I had never, ever dreamed of being. Within the year, I was traveling with my father to 10Ks and longer races around New Jersey. I'd start with him, then wait around the finisher's area for 20 minutes or more for him to methodically plod his way in, still looking like an idiot, but now no less or more than I did. My running quickly went from casual to obsessive. I saw each community 10K as a new crucible to throw myself into in order to burn away some more of my excess. My times improved, edging downward asymptotically toward the 40-minute mark, but never quite beating it. I became good enough that I tried out for and was accepted onto my high school's mediocre cross-country team, coached by a teacher who knew less about running than I did, populated by kids who, unlike me, looked like runners. When I showed up the first day for practice, I was wearing a souvenir shirt from a 10K, and one of the other runners asked if I had actually run it, or perhaps scavenged it from a corpse. That day, I remember, I went for my first practice run with the team and waxed him. I don't know if I ever ran that well again. My cross-country career lasted only a single season, and it wasn't particularly successful, partially because of a terrible bout of food poisoning, and partially because as much as I loved to race, I hated to be beaten, which I was regularly, like a drum announcing the hour. So many people ran in the community 10Ks I favored that I never had a hope of winning, but I couldn't really lose either, and instead ran for myself to improve my own time. In a competitive cross-country race, a few won and many lost, and I always lost against all those taller, athletic kids with a natural ability and competitive instinct. All I had to offer was a kind of naive stubbornness which faded the more I lost. I walked away from the team after my 1 year, deciding that the best roads to run on were the ones where my only competition was my past, slower self. As they say, those who can't play sports run, those who can't run, run long. Then came college and very little time to run, and the discovery that, as with many other talents I thought I had, my running was much less impressive at Harvard than it had been in Berkeley Heights, New Jersey. Many of the other students zipping by me on the banks of the Charles River when I could find a half hour to put on my old Pumas were legitimate track and cross-country stars who passed me as if the hedge funds they'd soon be managing were just across the next bridge. In my senior year, I had a brief but passionate romance with a young woman who had left her prior boyfriend for me when she changed horses again. The next steed was an ROTC officer who ran the Boston Marathon our senior year. A marathon? It seemed crazy, or superhuman, or both. My girlfriend left me for an insane superhero, one who might easily tear the head off my body if he could catch me, which he could easily. And so it went, through my 20s and into my 30s. For 5 years right out of college, I lived in Los Angeles, where running seemed dangerous enough to dissuade me. One night, I was running on the beach in Long Beach, when suddenly I was blinded as a spotlight from the sky bathed me in a bright circle of white light. I looked up expecting an alien ship and instead saw a police helicopter. Somebody was having some fun. Eventually, I realized all that brown stuff hanging around the horizon was being sucked into my lungs whenever I ran, and I gave up running to devote myself to more practical forms of exercise, like failure. Then came a move across the country and a career and a wife and a job and kids, and more moves interspersed with the occasional spate of running, until a day in 2002 when I went into the doctor for a routine physical. I stepped up on the scale and the doctor flicked the sliding piece of pig iron with his finger. Height 5'7", he said, weight 200 pounds. He didn't hear my screaming. It must have been muffled by all that fat. I began to jog again. I read Absolutely American, a terrific book about the military academy at West Point by David Lipsky, and became mildly obsessed with the story of one cadet, Jewish and stout, like me, who simply could not manage the running portion of the academy's physical fitness requirement. He kept trying to run the Army standard, 2 miles in 17 minutes, and kept failing. 2 miles in 17 minutes. I had been able to do that once. I put my middle daughter, age 2, into our running stroller and set out, instructing her to yell, "Faster, Papa, faster!" It took me a few tries and a few girlish yells, but I did it. So did the cadet, by the way, although he didn't have the use of a motivational toddler. Then we moved into a new house, a big old 4-story Victorian, and soon after that I woke up one morning to see runners zipping by. As it happened, the course of my suburb's annual 10K went right by our front yard. A 10K? I used to do those. The next year, 2004, I entered the race. Did pretty well, too, around 45 minutes. I was 39. I was 4 months from turning 40. I was afraid of dying. I decided to run the 2005 Chicago Marathon the next fall on the theory that if I did that, I would not die. You may mock, but it has worked so far. I made every rookie training mistake there was to make. I trained alone. I overdid it early. I injured myself. I aggravated the injury through more running, so I was forced to take a month off, and the marathon itself was incredibly painful. By the time I got to mile 22, a miserable, desolate stretch of freeway access road north of Comiskey Park, I would have quit happily. Except if I ever wanted to finish a marathon, I'd have to run 22 miles all over again, and that seemed far more painful than the measly 4 miles I had to limp through now. I stumbled through Bronzeville and willed myself up Michigan Avenue, and then I climbed the overpass of Roosevelt Road like it was Everest and turned left and stumbled through the finish line, and then, miserable and in pain and trembling from dehydration and exhaustion, I said to myself something I did not expect to hear myself say, something that became a hinge between my former life and my present and led to, among many, many other things, the writing of this book. I wonder if I could do that faster. Perhaps you would like to start running. You've never tried before, or you did and you hated it, and now you wonder how to begin moving in a way that will keep you going. Get up. Start. Go. Move. Take a rusty first step like the Tin Man. You will squeak. Go. Do not buy anything first. Jim Fix was right. You have everything you need right now. Someday you might buy better shoes or specialized clothing, but you do not need them now. You do not need a gym membership or a treadmill or special shoes with rockers built into the soles. We have a tendency to purchase things with the expectation that they will improve us or cause us to become fitter, more active. But we believe this because we are the helpless objects of a multi-billion-dollar, century-long campaign to convince us this is so, and partially because as a civilization, we are only a few hundred years removed from believing that praying to the bones of saints would cure our arthritis. In fact, we are still in the thrall of superstition. There is little difference between a man in Detroit buying sneakers with Michael Jordan's image on them in the hope that it will help him jump farther, and a Chinese man buying powdered rhino horn in the hope that it will make him more virile. No difference at all, in fact, other than the fact that the process is significantly less painful and final for Michael Jordan than it is for the rhino. It is all sympathetic magic, the atavistic human belief that we can impart to ourselves the essence of a thing via an image or symbol of that thing. No. You have everything you need to begin. If you don't have sneakers, just grab your most comfortable shoes or go barefoot on dirt or sand. If you don't have shorts, get an old pair of jeans and cut off the legs. If anybody judges you for wearing ratty clothes, one of the privileges and benefits of running is leaving people behind. Every first step is the same. Every last step is different. You step outside because real running is done outside, damn it, in the open air where the endorphins hide. You hitch up your pants or adjust your sports bra and swing your arms a bit, and you imagine the next 20 minutes or 2 hours with excitement or apprehension, or the kind of grim determination you might apply to eating something horrible in front of the person who made it just to be polite. You lift one leg and swing it out, and then spring the other leg, contracting the calf to flex the toes, and for one brief moment you fly upward, but you fail to fly and fall onto the extended heel of your forward foot, and you try to fly again and again and again, and you fail and fail and fail, and then you are down the street or road or driveway, and the run has become what it will be, different from every other run you'll ever have or attempt. Because every time you run, you leave a little something on the road and you pick up something to replace it. Every step and every run is a transformation from what you were into what you are becoming, a runner. But that is not the same kind of transformation as what is promised by the fitness clubs or the weight loss ads or the Bowflex infomercials. Those promise all of us poor suckers who hate ourselves a chance to transform into something else, something bigger or smaller or glossier or younger, something that can be oiled and lit. The muscle and fitness magazines on the airport kiosks are parasites, sucking on the fleshy folds of the self-loathing, and they belong not with the other athletic magazines, but with the tattoo and fetishist magazines, because they are for people who recoil from what they see in the mirror and want to erase it. Running isn't even like other sports. If you play tennis, you master movements and learn reflexes that are essentially unnatural. No Pleistocene man ever swung a racket. And this is even more true for stranger sports like football or lacrosse or water polo, or whatever latest version of centrifugal bumble puppy the guys on ESPN 16 are playing these days. When you run, you're actually trying to forget everything you've learned about moving and trying to remember how to do something you've forgotten. Try it now. Whatever you're listening to me on is probably portable. There, go. Fine. You did it. Both Bruce Springsteen and Christopher McDougall say we are born to run. And who are we to argue? Running may be the answer to one of the oldest mysteries of evolutionary biology. How exactly did humans ever survive once we dropped, or were thrown, with some disgust, out of the trees? We have no claws, no terrible jaws, and we have a tenth of the strength of our nearest relative, the chimpanzee. We have our brains, but proto-humans developed and thrived for a million years before the great leap forward of 50,000 years ago, when a small band of homos in Africa truly became sapiens and rapidly spread all over the world with their tools and culture to dominate the planet and eventually invent the Snuggie. No, we had some other secret weapon beyond and before our ability to wonder what it might be. The best guess as to what it might have been lies in the answer to another evolutionary question, one that's apparent every time you look in a mirror. Why aren't you covered with fur like every other living primate? What happened to our luxurious simian pelts? Darwin says it's because at some point in our distant ancestral past, it became more advantageous for our species to lose its fur than to keep it. But why? Almost every other land mammal sports thick fur or hair, testifying to its utility as insulator, camouflage, and protector of the fragile skin. Whatever we gave up fur for, it must have been important. The secret to the survival of that bizarre hairless ape, precariously balanced on two legs with its underbelly exposed to whatever efficient predator might want to casually disembowel it between bites of less stringy prey, is that it can run. We are evolved to run, or we were intelligently designed to run if you're stupid. Our hairless bodies let us sweat and cool. Our muscles can store enough energy for hours of effort. Our lungs keep the fires burning. A cheetah can run at a speed of 60 miles per hour, but only in short bursts, after which it has to sit down and read a magazine. But we humans can just keep on going, the energizer bunnies of the Serengeti, not fast like a cheetah or an antelope, or even in impressive mass stampedes like buffalo or horses or Walmart shoppers, but slowly, methodically, rhythmically, and for a long time with a persistence that was as deadly to our prey as it was annoying. Why the hell won't that thing stop? The exhausted emu said to itself before lying down and just giving up as we jogged up behind it, hungrier than we were before we started after it. Or so argues McDougall, who describes the last living example of persistence hunters, a small tribe in Africa, in his book, Born to Run. Bruce Springsteen's explanation of why we run is to get the hell out of New Jersey. And now, a million years later, as you get up every second day just to do another 3 miles around the housing development, heaving and breathing and trying to distract yourself with a new podcast, you are actually becoming, in tiny increments, the thing you were meant to be. The soft fat stored from a modern diet of processed industrial compounds starts to dissolve and drop away. Your unused muscles in your legs start to tighten and firm. Your lungs fill and empty and fill and become elastic and clear. Your heart, that small beating thing, strains to meet the stress and finds that it can. You can feel it growing in your chest cavity, like the Grinch's. It's like one of those modern vampire or zombie movies where some strange compound transforms the human body into something else, something much stronger, something much more dangerous than the weak and pasty suburbanites who become its prey. Instead of the walking dead, we are the running living. The urge to transform can come from within, from a sense of either loss or surfeit in your life. I have known people who ran because they felt there was something missing, and they thought if they could pick up some speed, they might find it. I've also known people who found themselves laden like Marley's ghost with chains of stress and responsibility and unwanted pounds, who began to run in the hope that all or some of it would shake off from all the jostling. Heraclitus said, "What does not change is the will to change, and thus our motivations are inexhaustible as we propel ourselves doggedly down the dawn streets. We are fueled by Gatorade in dissatisfaction. One of my heroes is Dan Savage, the author, sex advice columnist, and activist. Dan and I have some significant things in common. We are the same age. We are obsessive exercisers because we are terrified of getting fat, though Dan favors the gym rather than the roads, and we both love musical theater. Of course, Dan is also, famously, proudly, gay, argumentative, incredibly profane, and knows more about something called sounding than I ever want to. In fact, I only know what sounding is because I read about it in one of Dan's columns and I regret it to this day. I urge you not to look it up. Dan is a prolific coiner of neologisms and aphorisms, his most famous being It Gets Better, which is what he called the project in which he and his husband, as well as eventually thousands of other people, including the President of the United States, recorded messages for troubled or abused gay youth who needed hope for their future lives. He also came up with the campsite rule for relationships with much younger partners, leave them in better shape than how you found them, and the shorthanded advice DTMFA, or dump the motherfucker already, applied in cases in which a person is needlessly dithering over the latest in a long line of abuses and insults from their partner. Also among Dan's coinages is GGG, for good, giving, and game, which are the qualities he says every person should strive to have as a sexual partner. To the extent it's not self-explanatory, I'll leave you to Google Dan Savage GGG to let him explain it himself. I came up with my own variation of GGG for new runners. In this case, it is gradual, goal, and group. You need to make a gradual start because you're out of shape. What dissuades people from any new effort, at least most people, is the looming specter of failure. If you are unfit and you try to run a mile, you will collapse before it's over and agree to tell the Nazis whatever they want to hear. Most people hate running not because there is something painful or inherently torturous about running, but because it has been so long since the guileless runs of their childhood that they have lost all capacity for doing it. You'd hate eating, too, if you hadn't done it in 30 years and kept trying to put the food through the side of your cheek. There's a saying in weightlifting, train to failure, which means you want to stress the muscles to the point where they fail and you literally can't lift anymore. The notion is that the muscles will then repair themselves and grow bigger and stronger. Perhaps. But man, that hurts. I prefer another nostrum. Don't practice failure because that's what you'll learn. If you try to learn to run by getting up and running till you exhaust yourself, you'll end up exhausted and frustrated. If you give yourself a goal that is tough enough to require effort but not so hard that you can't succeed, you can engineer success. The trick is to make it hard enough to give you a small but real benefit by doing it, which, by coincidence, is about the same level of intensity that maximizes self-satisfaction. You are out of shape. You know you can't run a mile, but can you run steadily to the end of the block? Possibly. Maybe. You really don't know. You'll have to try it. You try it. You did it! Wow, that was tough! But you gutted it out until the Berkowitz's driveway, and from there to the end was pure Nietzschean will. Take a break, you deserve it. Walk a bit, maybe to the end of the next block. And then, when you get there, run one more block. You are basically treating yourself like a third grader at the start, giving yourself a participation medal for every day you get out of bed and get your shoes on. You are self-administering a dose of success, and you are trying to get yourself hooked. I'm not talking about the legendary runner's high, the chemical effect of exercise-induced endorphins on the brain. I'm talking about the pleasure of achieving something difficult, but not so difficult you can't achieve it. Second, you want an achievable goal. As Paul Karatza, the Austin, Texas running guru who trained George W. Bush, Rick Perry, and a whole bunch of other people you have strong opinions about, said to me while we ran around Austin's town lake, "We don't help people exercise. Exercise is a chore. We train athletes, and training is a pleasure." Let's say you would like to play guitar. I would. It would be wonderful if you could simply play the songs you'd like to play, but instead you have to learn to play gradually, strings, notes, chords, practicing each step painfully until your fingers can learn the motions, and it becomes easy, and you can move on to the next step. You do this not because it is itself rewarding, but because you have a goal in mind. You want to play Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, and you want to play it naked while wearing boots, like Miley Cyrus. This vision keeps you going through the difficulty and the hesitation and the frustration. Naked, you say to yourself, as your fingers ache to reach a bar chord. Work boots, you think, as you realize you have no idea what a G major seventh chord even is, let alone how to play one. And so, you persevere. Now, imagine if you had to get up every day and do those same things without any purpose but to train your fingers. The task set before you is to do nothing more than play a scale and a series of chords in progressive order. You work your fingers for hours and hours until you can do something pointless. You wouldn't be enjoying yourself, you wouldn't be getting any better, and you certainly wouldn't be doing anything that could be called playing the guitar. You'd be bored out of your mind, and you'd quit, as any sensible person would. That's how most people approach running. They decide, for whatever reason, that they need to exercise, perhaps to lose weight, perhaps to get in shape, though what shape, for what reason, is never specified. So they join a gym and get on the treadmill, or they buy one for their home. And then they do their 30 minutes or 3 miles three times a week, defeating the screaming boredom by watching TV or listening to the radio and generally counting down the minutes until this chore is over. Now, this is better than nothing. 30 minutes of aerobic activity three times a week is much better than indolence and can, in fact, help you lose weight and regain muscle tone, improve your energy, and help win the war for the Allies. So if that's all you can do and all you want to do, I say good for you, and I have nothing more for you except to comment that the only reason to watch Morning Joe at the gym on the treadmill is to be watching live on the day that Mika Brzezinski finally snaps and stabs Joe Scarborough to death with a mechanical pencil. Treadmills were invented as a form of forced labor in Victorian prisons. Oscar Wilde was forced to work on one in Reading Jail, powering a mill. And punishment for past sins, in my opinion, remains the only thing they're good for. Go outside. But if you want to be a runner, find that goal. An excellent first one is a 5K, or a 5-kilometer race. That translates to 3.1 miles, and that is within the reach of just about everyone, barring disability or injury. They are common, with one or more happening just about every weekend in any metropolitan area, and they often are held to benefit worthy causes. There will be people at that race who intend to try to win it and just might, but that won't be you. This will be unlike any other athletic contest you've ever tried, including intramural soccer and ping pong tournaments, in that you will enter it with no notion of possibly winning. You will enter it to finish it at a run. The running press and the internet are filled with programs such as Couch to 5K. None of them are objectively better than any other, although one might suit you and your schedule better, another worse. But each plan, if it's from a reputable source, will have the same general outline. Gradual progression from no fitness to speak of, the notional couch, to completing a 5K at a comfortable but still notable speed. Both the words gradual and progression are important. Any plan that starts you running too quickly or too far or for too long will burn you out within a week and you'll recoil. But the plan has to increase the load in your muscles and heart so that you actually improve. You will suffer. A bit. But as Paul Carrazza says, this time you are suffering for a concrete purpose, to arrive at the spring or fall or summer day when you will put on your shirt and shorts and tie your shoes and run a whole 3 miles without stopping. Instead of being Rocky Balboa going back and forth to his miserable job beating people up for a loan shark, you will be Rocky Balboa sprinting through the streets of Philadelphia on his way to his destiny. You will start when they fire a gun or sound a siren. You will run. You will finish when you step across a line and an announcer, with luck, says your name, rather than the name of the person right behind you or the one right in front of you. Then you'll get a medal, perhaps, and you will drink sports drink and eat a stale bagel that will be perfectly delicious, and you will note your time, 30 minutes, maybe 40, and you will say to yourself, perhaps, maybe I can do that faster. The last G stands for group, and it's been the hardest of the three Gs for me to get people to accept. A lot of people say they like running because it is a solitary sport, and it gives them a chance to be meditative and away from pressures and other people and blah, blah, blah. Yes, I know, you value your time alone. But I think that for many people, including myself, we are reacting out of fear and discomfort. We don't want to go to classes because the perky trainer at the front makes us feel embarrassed, not to mention fat. We don't want to run in front of anyone. If we were good at sports, then we wouldn't be running, would we? Get over it and find a running group. We humans, unless we are very strange humans, actually like other people. We enjoy talking to them, hanging out with them, and in some extreme cases, kissing them and making babies with them, which, not incidentally, provides more people to hang out with. Running with other humans is no different than any other pleasurable interaction, and in some ways, it's much better. To wit, it is not an open-ended commitment. You are going for a run. It may last 30 minutes, it may last an hour or even two, but it will end. Even if the person you've chosen to run with was not a wise choice, you can rest easy in that the ordeal will be over relatively soon. You do not have to worry about being sweaty, smelly, farting, burping, vomiting, or the occasional gastrointestinal distress. This is a run. Everybody is smelly, sweaty, farting, or something even more extreme. If you do not occasionally involuntarily expel something from your body while running, you're doing it wrong. You do not have to worry about how you look. Running is the sports equivalent of a nudist camp. We simply accept each other as we are, for in any other direction lies madness. You do not have to worry about being interesting. While running, anything becomes interesting, even the topic of running. Running is profoundly boring to talk about, except to other runners. Thus, don't think of your social runs as yet another time when you are obligated to be charming or fun or impressive. Accept them as a time when you can be and will be gloriously dull. My running friends and I have had lengthy, interesting conversations about such topics as porta-potties, chafing nipples, and various kinds of shoelaces. We talk about stomach, muscular and uterine cramps. We talk races and pacing and shoes. We talk about all the minutiae of running, and no one leaves because we are all constantly leaving together. You don't even have to look anyone in the eye if that causes stress. Everyone's looking ahead. I should mention, at this point, that running sometimes sucks. There's no point in hiding it from you, and later on we'll speak more about it. There will be days on which the weather is awful, the footing terrible, the mood black, the stomach unhappy, the legs aching, and the head woozy. But misery, as is well known, loves company. And more to the point, like most burdens, sharing this one makes it lighter. Running 13 miles in a rainstorm by yourself is miserable, stupid, pointless, and the sort of thing that will make you reconsider indolence, obesity, and an early death. The same experience with a band of friends is your very own St. Crispin's Day, a shared misery, a story you will tell and retell again and again until you get bored of it, which will be never. 7 or 8 years ago, my running friends and I went for a run on a sub-zero freezing day and decided, on the advice of one of them, to run a trail through the woods, including across a frozen, snow-covered stream. My foot broke through the ice, and I soaked my running shoe and sock in the frigid water. We've told the story of that day 400 times since then, and it gets better every time. I believe, in the latest iteration, I was submerged into the ice cap up to my waist, and I remained frozen there like Satan in the lowest level of Dante's Inferno. If I had been alone, it would have been just a private misery, the memory of which would occasionally make me shudder for a few years after. Because I was with a group, it's a glorious story of adversity defeated. Then again, if I had been alone, I wouldn't have run into the goddamn stream. And, insofar as we are naturally social animals, we are also naturally competitive. I don't mean we wish to triumph over our friends, although that can be a fun way to spend an afternoon if you've got time to kill in a set of Settlers of Catan. What I mean is that we tend to measure ourselves against other people, because measuring ourselves against other species or inanimate objects makes no sense. We will never be as adorable as that puppy or as tall as that cell phone tower, but we might, if we try, be as fast as our friend Ken, who is roughly our age, height, and weight. We might even beat him someday. Your running friends should be roughly at your level of fitness with similar goals. You get no benefit from running with people you can't keep up with or who can't keep up with you. But the key word is roughly. Ideally, you should be the second slowest person in your group. Having a number of friends who are constantly just ahead of you at the track, just a little more comfortable and faster in the long runs, who can go just a little farther without a break, means you'll be constantly pushing yourself to catch up, and keep going. And pressing your limits means you will be constantly improving. Any running is good, but running just on the edge of your ability after comfort and before crisis is the best. You will come to love your running friends, and you will express your affection for them by trying to kick their asses, or at least keeping them from kicking yours. Why the second slowest? Because it sucks to be last. Finally, of all the people we know, we are often the least kind to ourselves. We are the ones we disappoint. We are the ones we mistreat. We are the ones we betray by going back on promises to improve and to never make that mistake again. We are the ones we punish most. If you say to yourself, I'm going to get up and run every other day because it's good for me, then me is going to be going without that run within a few weeks. But if you have agreed to be on the corner of 6th and Main at 6 a.m. to meet the guys for your run, then before you turn over and go back to sleep, you will have to grapple with the fact that you are going to be letting those guys down. What you would do to yourself without a care of the cost, you'll hesitate about doing to the guys. So you'll get up and you will go. And there you will find the guys who have shown up despite the early hour, despite the darkness and the fatigue, because they didn't want to let you down. They're better to you than you are. It's also possible that running friends might become your friends in real life. This can be odd because it's strange to see people you normally see sweaty and in short pants, dry and in trousers, and so I don't recommend it. But hey, it's your life, do what you want. But find a group. What's coming your way will be more easily handled with a show of force. 3. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon and 30 degrees out, warm for a day in mid-February, which was fortunate because I was standing on Market Street in St. Louis in my underwear, next to a guy dressed as Braveheart, without a shirt, but with face paint, blue, and a sword, foam. I waved my arms around, trying to stay warm without hitting anybody with the Cupid's bow and arrow I was holding. Then the starter, such as she was, cupped her hands around her mouth and yelled, "Go!" and everybody started running, except for me, because Braveheart decided to rally the 300 nearly naked people behind us by swinging his sword, which whacked me hard in the face. He took off. I grabbed at my nose, swore, hitched up my red boxer briefs, and chased after him. Welcome to the beta test of life as a divorced dad. This was an intentional test run. It was the winter of 2013, about 2 months before the Boston Marathon, a race that, on this cold day, I had no notion I would be running. My wife and I had agreed in January to separate and then divorce, and my soon-to-be ex had taken the kids to visit her parents in Minnesota. Under the circumstances, she suggested, it might be awkward for me to accompany them. Perhaps I should have argued, but they had taken such trips without me before, and this seemed like a strange time to insist on coming along. Besides, there was no time like the present to start getting used to the future as a part-time parent. At the same time, I didn't want to mark this first solo divorced dad weekend by lying around the house eating takeout of my underwear and watching porn. That seemed to be a bad way to set the tone. Instead, I would do a road trip of my own. How about St. Louis? I had friends there, and it was also about a day's drive away, and happily, psychologically and geographically, in the opposite direction. But I needed a better excuse. One of the habits I have been criticized for in the bosom of my family, justly, is constantly needing some sort of activity to amuse myself rather than just, you know, being. So what could I do? A race? I like to do races. One of my St. Louis friends told me about a race a friend of hers was doing, something called the 4th Annual Cupid's Undie Run. Whatever. I'm in. On New Year's Eve 2009, a 20-something in Washington, D.C. named Bobby Gill was talking with his friends Chad Leathers and Brendan Hanrahan, who were also, I'm sure, in their 20s, about doing something for Chad's younger brother, who was afflicted with neurofibromatosis, or NF, an extremely unpleasant pediatric disease that causes chronic tumor growth. All three friends were runners, so they thought of a fundraising race, but then said to one another, why do another 5K? Nobody remembers a 5K. And came upon the idea of running in their underwear. This is how I know they were in their 20s. They just assumed that their friends wouldn't mind running in public in their underwear. They decided they needed a holiday to link to it for marketing purposes, one that was coming up soon. Martin Luther King Jr. Day? Not quite right. Valentine's Day? Great! Then it will be red underwear. I called Bobby on my way down to St. Louis, and he told me they'd expected about 50 of their friends to show up that first time and strip to their skivvies before doing a guerrilla sprint on the sidewalk circling the Capitol. But word spread around the D.C. running community with the speed of a nearly naked young person trying to get out of the cold. On February 13th, 2010, more than 600 people swarmed Capitol Hill, a mass of jiggling, goose-pimpled bear flesh, raising $10,000 for the Children's Tumor Foundation. 3 Valentine's days later, in February 2013, the race was held in 14 U.S. cities, plus Sydney, Australia, with thousands of participants attempting to reach a $1 million goal. For me, there would be two very unusual things about the race, and that did not include the underwear. First, perhaps because of the cold weather, perhaps because they wanted to attract a wider pool of participants than the cadre of hardcore runners, Bobby and company had set the distance at 1 mile. And further, it would be informal, untimed, and not even accurately measured. Call it a mile-ish. You know, out that-a-way for about half a mile or so, then turn back. I made a note to myself, don't try to set an international record for the mile distance, because it won't count. Second, it was for charity. This may seem like a bonus, but for a serious runner, charity running can have a disreputable air. The Boston Marathon, as said, requires entrance to qualify by running a sufficiently fast time at a prior accredited marathon. To run Boston, you have to earn it. Or if you don't want to put in the work, sign up with some charity, promise to raise or donate a set amount of money, and they'll give you a bib. Easy. Then there are the countless charitable organizations that promise to help you train up to run a marathon or half marathon, all for a large fee that mostly, probably, goes to the charity, rather than the coaches and t-shirts and other accoutrements of very public do-gooding. This sort of stuff made me narrow my eyes and sniff and think that if you really wanted to train for a marathon, you should grind out the miles in misery, unsupported, like God intended. But I needed some distraction on my first divorced weekend. Having run countless half marathons and 10Ks and 10-milers, a mile-ish run in my underwear in a cold winter day seemed like it would be at least a significant change of pace. But if I was going to raise money, even on a lark, then damn it, I would raise some money. I had only a week to fundraise after deciding to run the race, but I went to it with a vengeance. I set up a donation page and then tweeted out appeals, offering to post a picture of myself running in my underwear when I met my $1,000 goal. And then when that goal was quickly reached, I announced that if I hit $2,000, I wouldn't post it. Over the course of my single week of fundraising, I began tracking the thermometer-style money graph on my fundraising site like it was an indicator of my value as a human being. In response to many lewd suggestions as to what underwear I should wear, I posted an offer. Anybody who donated $500 could dictate my costume. I was amazed, and more than a little worried, when somebody took me up on it. But I put my qualms aside. I was raising money, lots of it, anything to make that needle move, and it was moving. As far as addictions involving needles went, I could do worse. Still, I was nervous when I walked into Cyberg's bar in St. Louis on the Saturday of the race, and not just because of what I was wearing and not wearing under my sweats. The place was packed with people, mostly young, mostly drinking, and mostly naked. Very few of them, by my informal survey, which I conducted by asking them, had ever run a race before. Most of them had no knowledge or interest in NF or the Children's Tumor Foundation, but had shown up, it seemed, because drinking beer and gallivanting around in their underwear in public on a Saturday afternoon sounded like fun. So as it turns out, there are hobbies stranger than running. There were some older folk mixed into the crowd, and although they seemed to be grinning as much as anyone else, they were there for a more serious purpose. Every person I spoke to over the age of 35, including Amanda, the race director, was there because of a direct connection to a child suffering from NF. A group of older runners had brought one such child, the daughter of one of their coworkers. Lexi seemed shy and frail, but delighted to be surrounded by so much determined love. One of Lexi's supporters told me their employer, the St. Louis Area Water Utility, was suspicious and worried about this undie thing, and insisted they run clothed, which is why the entire group was wearing extra-large unmentionables over tights and t-shirts. She seemed regretful. And me? Having stripped off my sweats, I was talking to this perfectly nice, complete stranger in the outfit decreed by my $500 donor. A pair of red boxer briefs with the words Knickers of Glory written on the butt, red feathered wings on my back, a Cupid's bow and arrow in my hands, and a heart shaved into my chest hair. I envied the utility worker in her tights. At that point, I would have preferred a burqa. I ordered a beer from the bar. I would have had another, but naked and shivering and shaved and drunk seemed one adjective too far. So I shuffled outside and waited with the crowd, most of them much younger and much more attractive than me, although few of them were more naked. The race started. I got hit in the face with a foam sword. Then I whooped and ran. At first I gave in to my usual instinct and tried to keep up with the leaders, a few skinny guys who hadn't laden themselves with props. But after about 100 yards, I actually said out loud, "What am I doing?" and slowed down, circled back, and joined the vast, unclothed masses. This was supposed to be fun, and today there was no fun in me being out in front, especially for the people right behind me. The turnaround point was a half mile up a slight hill, and before we were very far up it, a lot of the cuties in their undies were walking, either due to too little training or too much alcohol. They were all still laughing, and so was I. I had never been in an event like this, hardly dressed, hardly running in what was hardly a race. Then I decided I wanted to get to the finish line to watch people as they came in, so I sprinted the last few 100 yards. Somebody shouted out, "Not fair! He's got wings!" I jumped to make them flap. At the finish, people laughed and hollered and cheered as they completed their mile run as if they had just won the Olympic marathon. They hugged their friends and acted more sweaty and intimate than usual, and everybody immediately retired into the bar for more beer. There, the organizers quieted the DJ and took over the bar's PA system. They announced best costume, some 20-year-old and something revealing, and then they announced the event's big winner, the top individual fundraiser. It was me. My wheedling, my begging, my bargaining, my offers to wear whatever ridiculous thing my big donor suggested had brought in $4,000 for the Children's Tumor Foundation, and I accepted my medal, in the shape of underwear, of course, with a huge grin. It was the first time I'd ever won a race of any kind, by any measure, and it struck me, as I grinned and grinned, standing in my underwear in front of a crowd, that I had picked a great one to win. I have run thousands of miles for myself, and won, just one, lousy mile up a hill and back, for some sick kids I had never met, and at that moment, it seemed to me the only mile I had ever run that mattered. Clutching my medal, my costume safely and securely concealed again under my sweats, I walked back to my hotel and wondered if that was true. Had all the miles I'd run, all the races I'd finished, all the PRs I'd set been useless, other than this silly and formal jog up and down a cold St. Louis Boulevard? Obviously not. I had lost weight, gained energy, learned discipline and focus, generally improved my health and disposition. But what good did any of it do? What is running for? Once upon a time, of course, it was essential. Even after we left the hunter-gatherer stage, the ability to move quickly over ground proved essential to all kinds of human pursuits, most importantly, the violent ones. A horse, obviously, can outrun a human, but a human can run longer without tiring, even beating the horse in a marathon, at least on a hot day. Horses overheat. We sweat. According to legend, when the Greeks needed to send word of their victory at Marathon back to Athens, they didn't send a horseman or a pigeon. They sent a man, Pheidippides, who ran the whole way, delivered the message, and died. The worst post-run celebration ever. Even in World War II, messages were sent across a battlefield by use of runners, who, we can presume, ran. But now, well, sometimes you get to the bus stop just as the bus is leaving, and if you run, you might be able to get up to the door and get the attention of the driver, and if she's in a generous mood, she might stop the bus and let you on. But otherwise, running as a skill seems to have no practical value in this world. This used to bother me a lot back in high school when the various things I could do, write, act, make smart-ass remarks, didn't do much to impress anyone, by which I mean girls. And the things I couldn't do, play sports, purchase beer, have clear skin, seemed unobtainable. So over the course of many, many solitary laps run around my suburb, I came up with a scenario that went something like this.
Fade in. Deep woods, daytime. A lovely young woman lies on the ground, a snake bite on her thigh. A doctor cradles her head as she bravely fights for life. Doctor? She only has 2 hours to live, and the only antidote is 5 miles away. We have no transportation and no way to communicate. She's doomed. Unless someone here can run 10 miles in 90 minutes or less. The football star, the class president, and the handsome musician looked down helplessly. Peter steps forward. He peels off his jacket, revealing a running singlet. Peter, I'll be right back.
In the course of my marriage, I would often compare my sole hobby, even as I began to get good at it, to my wife's. Raised by crafty Midwesterners, she could cook, sew, draw, play the piano, sing, and decorate a house. Me? I could run, Maybe after an apocalypse I could fetch far-off supplies. Couldn't be something heavy, though, because it's hard to run while carrying things. Your hand gets sweaty if you hold it, and a backpack bounces around. Of course, something happens every day in every country around the world in which the ability to run far and relatively fast is essential to success.